Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And that, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 187.
Interview with Lobby T-Dar. Truth, justice, and the Lobby T-Dar way.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm David.
And obviously our special guest today is Lavi Tidar. Welcome to the show again.
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me again.
So I want to start with a question I don't think we asked you last time you were here, which is a while back. We interviewed you about Asama, which I think was pretty much one of my favorite books from that particular year. It was, I think, the year before last, 2012?
It was 2011, book.
Oh, wow, okay.
Well, 2011, yeah.
That's a long time ago. Okay.
It's been a strange sort of journey from that book.
No, in what sense, actually? Just kind of elaborate on that.
Well, I can't remember when we talked. I mean, the book sort of came out from a small press in the UK at the end of 2011, I think. I could be wrong. And so at that point, I wasn't really expecting anything to happen with it. It was, I gave it a good shot, but it was a book that a lot of publishers rejected at the time. And, and I moved back to the UK at that point as well. So there was all that about, after 5 years of summer, suddenly finding myself in the middle of winter in London without a book deal and with, basically it was a very strange position to be in when suddenly Osama started kind of picking up reviews and and picking up award nominations, which I wasn't expecting at all at that point. And it all kind of clicked into place in some way that I was working on this new book, the Violent Century, at over a year at that time. And suddenly Osama got the World Fantasy Award, and he got the World Fantasy Award a week after I finished the final draft of The Violent Century. So it was a very strange position to suddenly be in, a position where you have this, relatively big award that got quite a lot of attention, and to have a new book out on submission that sold, pretty much immediately, as opposed to Osama that, like I said, no one wanted to buy at all. And it's been a strange roller coaster of ups and downs, which I think is sort of what the writing life is like. It's what old fashion, if you watch Project Runway, one day you're in and the next day you're out. So it's been a very strange journey from 2011 to now.
And it did get a mass market release, didn't it?
Yeah, he did get a mass market release from Solaris Books, and he got a lot of foreign rights deals, relatively speaking. You know, so it came out this year. It came out in Germany, in France, in Poland, in Spain. You know, and for some reason, it's got really good reviews in Germany. The Germans really liked it, you know. So I don't think anyone reads it in America, to be honest with you, but the Germans liked it. So it's a strange sort of thing. But, you know, I did pretty much think my career was over when Osama came out, to an extent. So it's very nice to be in a position where you know, apparently it's not yet finished.
You've still got some time left.
Yeah, I got you know, still plodding along.
Excellent. So the question I wanted to start with, Osama obviously was one of my favorites, and so it's really interesting to hear that your kind of experience with its publication and what has now been, as you say, a roller coaster. But since you're still writing genre fiction, and in this particular case, you're writing. I think there's a similarity here with Osama in terms of maybe the weirdness. But what I want to ask is what continues to draw you to genre fiction? Why do you keep coming back to it, whether as a reader or as a writer?
It's actually a bit of a tricky question to ask me right now, because in a way I'm kind of exhausted with writing genre.
Uh-oh.
Well, no, it's partly because, you know, I write a lot of short stories. That's really what I love doing, is short stories. And I've done quite a few short stories, you know, over the last years. Including, I've been working on these very ambitious sort of, you know, these science fiction stories that are very much science fiction stories, you know, which I didn't get to really write in novel length, but I get to play around with short stories. And the science fiction stories kind of all take place in the same future history, in the same way that Heinlein or particularly Cordrainer Smith did it back in the day. You know, they're all set in the same universe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think you can probably fill about 3 volumes of books with those stories at this point. And I've been working for about 2 or 3 years. I've been working on a cycle of short stories set in kind of in Tel Aviv in the far future, which I finally finished, you know, just last year, just about a month ago. And I suddenly realized I just can't write any more science fiction. It's kind of like I've done it so much that I need to try and do something that I'm not comfortable with doing. So I'm actually kind of playing around with writing crime fiction, trying to do some, you know, which is a completely alien thing for me. So it's really interesting to try and do that. Although you do kind of keep thinking maybe aliens should show up after the assassination, you know, or, you know, the mobster turns out to be a superhero in disguise or something. But it's actually really nice to just do something very low key and very very different. So I'm not sure. But to answer the question, you know, what attracts me to writing genre is firstly, you know, I'm mostly wired that way, that there's got to be something weird going on, of whatever nature. But I also think, more seriously, I think it's probably the best way of looking at the world we live in through this weird lens, because the world we live in is incredibly weird, you know. And I think science fiction at its best can ask some really, really big questions that, you know, fiction that pretends to be realist doesn't, you know, because we can only really take realist fiction, you know, fiction about people and about relationships and about, you know, day-to-day life, is if we ignore the wider universe around us, which is a very strange and wonderful place that isn't really designed for humans very much. You know, so I'm really interested in kind of writing about the big cosmological questions in a future book, I think. Yeah.
Is this you secretly saying that you're going to possibly write a space opera?
I've been thinking about a space opera. I don't I don't think I'm going to be doing it right this minute. I don't know. Books, in a way, novels are not my natural thing. I just find them so long to write. And you kind of, every time you start a book, you think, how the hell do people do this? And especially, how do they do those really big books, 140,000 words. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, 140,000 words is about three different books. It's not something that comes very easily to me. But every time I finish a book, I have no idea what I'm going to do or how I'm ever going to write another book. I prefer spending a lot of my time messing about and doing short stories and doing, trying a screenplay or trying, doing a comic. And then gradually I get tired of kind of messing around and I just want to get up in the morning and know what I'm supposed to do that morning, which is something you don't get when you're writing short stories. So I have some ideas. Obviously, I just finished a new novel that I sent to my editor just last month. So I'm still waiting to hear about that.
Oh, excellent. Well, I see Paul had his hand up, so I'll let Paul jump in here.
I did. I wanted to branch off from what you were talking about writing genre fiction. I've always seen your fiction as not quite pure science fiction or pure fantasy. I mean, you throw in noir elements, you throw in alternate history, you put very often phantasmagoric elements into your fiction. I mean, I was thinking of your steampunk trilogy, for example. Why do you like to blend things like that rather than going for more of the more standardized tropes of science fiction? Why do you like to throw in all this other stuff to mix into the fiction you write? What draws you to do that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to answer in a way because in a way it's me saying because this is what I like, right? Or this is how they just come out. But I don't have much interest in genre purity. I mean, it's also genre is something to a large extent. It's just something that comes out of the pulp classification from American pulps in the 30s and 40s. Mm. And I think if you grow up outside of that, in a way, you're not as aware of those borders, So you can say, I'm going to have a bit of crime in here, and I'm going to have a bit of fantasy in here. I'm going to have all these different elements. I don't think it matters necessarily. You need to use what works for your story. But, what draws me is obviously I'm very interested in crime fiction partly because I love the construction of it. I love how when it's done well, it's done very directly and very effectively. I'm very interested in the Western. All these different elements. But when I approach writing something, I kind of like having these formula stories because I'm interested in the idea that a story has a shape, it has a formula, but at the same time, I don't want to just write a story to fit a formula. I want to use the formula to twist the story around. And I think the fact that we have certain expectations from a crime story or a Western or a science fiction story, it's fun to play with those expectations to an extent. At the end of the day, what I want to do with the books is I want to talk about things that matter, or about, like I said, about the big questions. But it's very interesting for me to do it from a kind of pulp perspective. Because I think pulp really informs the way that we construct the world today. The example I keep bringing up is George Bush's Axis of Evil speech, which kind of belongs in a superhero comic or in a pulp novel. It's that idea of black and white, good versus evil. Those are kind of narratives that are shaping real life and real politics and real wars. So it's very hard not to write about it. Mm.
We live in a pulpish world. I see your point.
We do. We absolutely do.
I was wondering that if you could wanted to elaborate on those questions that you were just referring to with regards to the violent century, since you've obviously there's the pulp aspect of it, the superhero element, but you've also given us a very different kind of alternate history in that it's not really alternate, right? The history still unfolds the way it has for us. So I'm wondering if you might want to sort of talk about what you were saying about that through the pulp fictional lens that you used with the superheroes.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, The Violent Century is a very accidental book for me. You know, I wasn't planning on writing it. Yeah, I mean, what it does, it's as you said, it's not really an alternate history, and it's not really a secret history. What drew me to it, well, where it started from, is from a conversation with a film producer friend about superheroes, you know, which is not something I'm particularly interested in. I don't really have much patience with superheroes, not with the films and not with the comics, and, you know, it's always seemed a bit silly. But, you know, my point was to, when you go back to the core of it, you know, they all came from... you know, first generation Jewish American kids, mostly in New York, whose parents escaped Europe, you know, for the New World. And you have these geeky Jewish kids growing up while the war in Europe is coming to fruition and Hitler's rise to power. And we have the foreshadow of the Holocaust. And that's really where the superheroes came from. You know, Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, the Hangman. If you look up early, you know, Hangman comics, you know, he fights Hitler. You know, they all fought Hitler to begin with, the superheroes.
Captain America, don't forget him.
Yep.
Yeah. But, you know, and I think that's what interested me, that firstly, the question of why is this archetype so popular, so successful all of a sudden? You know, why is it so prevalent and where it comes from? And it comes from a very, very real place in history, you know, from real conflict, real danger. And that's what drew me to start looking at that idea, really, is the origins of the concept, rather than the concept itself. Yeah, it's tricky to answer, but, you know, and again, it keeps drawing parallels between reality and pulp. And one of the examples in the book, I think, is Dr. Mengele in Auschwitz, you know, which is kind of... you know, this mad scientist, this horrible mad scientist, which is a figure that basically should belong in a pulp fiction novel, not in real life.
Yeah, he is an absolute... Yeah, he should have an hollowed-out volcano as a base.
Yeah, but yet this, I think what's terrifying about that idea is that those kinds of people exist. And so, you know, this idea that we're splitting these, that we're thinking of the world, as Paul was saying, like we live in a pulp world, I think really makes it interesting, because the pulps, as Levy was saying earlier, is this kind of idea of having very clear black and white characters. You know, there's the good guy and then there's like the evil bad guy. But like sometimes that's just real life. There are just people who are not good people and there's almost no redeemable quality about them. I don't know if that was something you'd intended to put into the book, but there was no point in which I saw that character and I was like, I kind of understand why he is that way. No, I was like, I just really hope you die because he's a horrible person.
Well, I mean, I do kind of like most of the characters in the book, but, you know, I can't really see myself ever writing a villain, because I think I can't really see good and evil as two discrete things. And, you know, this is something that my next book talks about quite a lot as well, is that banality of evil, you know, that evil is something that, you know, it could have been any one of us, in a way. And that's, you know, and that's what I'm interested in. So, I can't ever see someone who's evil in the sense of like an epic fantasy evil wizard or, you know, or even Hitler, who is actually the subject of my next book. You know, it was very, very interesting to kind of try to get into Hitler's head and to try to understand where he comes from and what he was like as a person. So that was what most of what I spent last year doing, basically, was living inside Adolf Hitler's head, which is not the nicest place to be.
Good grief.
I would imagine not.
That's an understatement. but I guess like the idea that you're getting at is... these concepts of good and evil that we have are they're inadequate because they're maybe simplifications of, you know, any one of us could become evil or bad or whatever. That's maybe something that's specific to just human experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think the book kind of struggles with the question of what makes a hero. You know, I don't know if it answers it, but it's, you know, you think of all the people who didn't fight it or just went along with it, and I kind of think that I would have been one of those people. I would have just gone along with things, you know, and by the time everything went to pot, it would be too late to do anything about it.
Well, actually, go ahead. Sorry, I was going.
No, go ahead.
Well, that what you were saying there actually made me think of Von Braun, who appears in your book, who in the book is building, you know, rocket men basically for the Nazis. But that you have this moment in the book, I think it's like around page 120 or something like that, middle of the book, where we actually go into his head and you actually learn that, yeah, he is doing all this stuff for them. He doesn't actually care about the ideology. He's just sort of being pragmatic about it. Like, he's in a position where here are his options. He could do his work under this regime or he doesn't do the work at all. And so he gets to a point at the end where he realizes things are going to pot and he's now trying to figure out, how do I get to the Americans to continue my work? I think that's kind of like that perfect moment of what you're kind of suggesting here.
Well, von Braun is an interesting example, isn't it? Because he basically had his own secret lair, didn't he? He had the mad scientist secret base. He had his own island where they developed, you know, weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you can't get any more pulpy than that. But at the same time, this wasn't pulp. This was real war. And what was interesting was, after the war was over, which was the period that I was interested in the book, was the immediate post-war period, is you have the Americans running around all over Europe trying to find rocket scientists to bring them over to the United States in Operation Paperclip, you know, which is one of the things discussed in the book. And von Braun actually ends up moving to America, you know, and there's accusations that he used slave labor, you know, from a nearby concentration camp and so on. But all these guys, and that's something that appears in the book with the superhero characters, but all these guys, all these rocket scientists and, you know, wanted war criminals, if they were deemed useful, they were brought over to America under new identities and recruited to work for the United States. So Werner von Braun really was a key figure in NASA. You know, he's one of the reasons that the Apollo missions happened in the first place, because he designed the rockets. So we have all those, you know, and it's, things are not clear cut.
Yeah.
But we have all these...
Oh, go ahead, Levy.
We have all this classic imagery of pulp science fiction of the rockets launching into space. And you think, well, the actual space program we have was built on Nazi scientists using Jewish slave labor.
Well, it's the same thing that can be said also about a lot of medical technologies. I mean, the really scary part about some of the things we learned, we actually learned things from the Nazi regime over the experiments they were conducting, which is something we don't talk about as a culture, the sort of legacy of some of our, like skin grafting as an example. I mean, they did experiments where they did that kind of stuff. I think I get what you're getting to, this point that, you know, things are a lot more gray than we want to admit, even with something like World War II, where everybody kind of thinks there was a good and a bad side. It suddenly gets very not so clear cut, when you look into the finer details.
As if we're standing on the shoulders of monsters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just, you know, it's just the way life is. Life isn't clear cut. And fiction should reflect that. You know, ideally, while being entertaining at the same time. Otherwise, you might as well write a non-fiction book. So, you know, I'm partly motivated by the fun element of pulp fiction. You know, I wouldn't want to write something that wasn't enjoyable. But at the same time, I don't want to write something that is simplistic or too simplistic.
That's a fair point. I see, David, you're saying hand.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I guess just kind of jump back into specifics about the book. Something you'd mentioned earlier in a couple different ways about heroism. And I mean, this isn't exactly a profound question to ask, but because it's on the back of the book that this is a novel that's about, to some extent, unsung heroes and what it means to be a hero throughout the book. And I was kind of curious about what compelled you to explore this particular aspect of, in your sense, it's that you said it was kind of like a secret history, but at the same time, it's about people who are being asked to do things for which they will never receive recognition. So what was kind of the impetus or the desire to write about this particular aspect of the war?
Well, to be honest, like I said, the whole thing was accidental. I had no plans of writing this book, and I had no interest in superheroes whatsoever. And I had a conversation with a film producer friend, and she said they were looking for a British superhero film, but they've never found the right script for it. And that's what started me off, because I fired off an email just saying, well, of course not, you know, because it's absolutely ridiculous to think of, you know, British superheroes. Because you have to understand it in context of this American, you know, American dream and the color and, you know, the war and so on and so forth. And as I'm writing this email, I'm starting to think, you know, that's not such a bad idea. And I said, obviously, you know, if you did have British superheroes, they'd have to be more like spies. They would be in the shadows. You wouldn't actually see them. You know, they'd be working in a bureaucratic sort of institution for king and country. So I kind of thought that's not a bad idea, and wrote a few pages of script and then forgot about it. And I essentially I got stuck somewhere for a couple of months with nothing to do. And I ended up writing a screenplay based on that, you know, which is kind of like the first start of the violent century. And when I came back, my friend read the script and she said she really liked it. But, you know, it's a big film. It's something like you're going to need $250 million just to make it. So she said, why don't you try and turn it into a book? And again, I kind of went, that's not a bad idea. You know, so I started doing that. But of course, you know, a screenplay and a book are two completely different things. So it's the book is very, very different from the original screenplay. It's, and it was a very hard book to write. I mean, like I said in the past, Osama was such an easy book to write. You know, it really was an absolute pleasure to sit down and just write it. The Violent Century was hell. It took me about 11 drafts, I think, in total by the time we got to publication. And I liked the book. That's why it's hard for me to talk about books. You know, I liked the book up to the proofreading stage, you know, when it was already set. It was just about ready to go. And I had to go over the proofs. And I could not see why anyone would have written that book. I just couldn't see anything good with it at all at that point. But I figured, you know, I did like it up to that point, and that was about 10 drafts that I did like it. So I'm hoping it's not. But yeah, at that point, I just couldn't see that book anymore.
I figure it makes total sense. Like, you know, you've been going through this process, and then you get the final step, which is you have to read the book looking for typos. Not the most fun point, is it?
No, it's... but, you know, you whenever you do that, you can start seeing all the faults you've put in. I mean, at the moment, you know, recently I'm playing with the idea of turning Osama into a screenplay. I've got a director, a young director who's been interested in the book. And it's a really interesting process. I'm really fascinated by adapting one thing into another thing. You know, whether you're turning a screenplay into a comic book or you're turning a book into a screenplay. And so I went over Osama, again, not really reading through the whole thing, but, you know, obviously going through the book. And I can see all the things that I kind of got wrong that I would have changed and I would have you know, that don't quite work. But at the same time, that's the book as it was written. And I think you can always say, oh, I'd like to change this, I'd like to fix that. But I don't think that necessarily improves things once you've done them.
You're a different writer now than you were when you wrote Osama.
Yeah, I'm a different person to an extent. And yeah, I think that applies to every book and or everything you write. I think beyond a certain point, you need to just leave it and just let it be on its own. But I can see all the faults in, you know, everything, in everything I've done. So, yeah, it can be frustrating.
Looks like David has a question.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could say a few words about the structure of The Violent Century. With its fragmentary moving back and forth in time, it seemed to me that it was perhaps reflecting the nature of the Womack wave with its, you know, had happened, will happen, is happening. Or what you were saying earlier about the love of short stories, I was wondering if that was being reflected in the structure too.
Well, the structure was actually simplified quite a bit at a certain point. I think the last draft of the book was the draft where I actually said, look, you've made it far too complicated and it's unnecessary. And that was the point where the book was actually streamlined. So it roughly follows events from the 1930s to 2001 and then goes back to the post-war period. But up to that point, it was actually jumping around a lot more. And in hindsight, that was probably unnecessary. You know, so it is sort of chronologically arranged, mostly, at the moment. Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily interested in, you know, I'm interested in experimenting with whatever I write. And at this particular point, I thought this was the book that needed to move back and forth because it's kind of an investigation into events that happened a long time ago. And it makes sense for an investigation like this to kind of meander a little bit, you know, and you go off on a tangent and then come back. I think we did simplify it a fair amount in the final draft. So you can only imagine how confusing it would have been, you know, to begin with. But, you know, it's like, for example, I've seen a lot of comments from random people just saying, oh, I'll never read a book that doesn't have quotation marks in it, which is, you know, fair enough. But the way the book was written, you know, which is kind of, you know, it's got a very specific style, and I've seen some, you know, very negative reviews of the way it's written. And the truth was, when I started writing it, and to me it felt the right way to do it. You know, every story kind of has a way that needs to be written, and a lot of it is about finding the right voice for it. And to me, this felt like the right voice. But I showed the first 10,000 words as I started to my agent, and he was initially very taken aback by it. And he said, you know, why can't you try and write it like a normal book? You know, kind of, you know, third person, past tense with normal dialogue and so on. And you know, and I thought, you know, you're probably right. I mean, why am I complicating things necessarily? So I tried to do it. I tried to write it in a kind of traditional, you know, which is a very pulpy way, very genre way of writing, isn't it? Just do it in that way. And it didn't work. It was absolutely a disaster. And the result of it was that I stopped working on the book for about 3 months because I couldn't make it work that way. And after 3 months, I just thought, you know what? My way is the right way. I'm always right. No. And I just came back to it and kept writing it the way I started writing it. And, you know, it seems to have worked. I can't complain.
I mean, you could certainly say that there is still a strong tradition of the pulp in there, in that you get a sense of discrete adventures, almost like it's a serial that we're encountering. You leave us with one cliffhanger after another as we work our way through the stories.
Yeah, it very much has the pulp in it. I mean, in a way, for example, the Transylvanian section draws a lot on a story I had in a small collection called Hebrew Punk, and another story called Transylvanian Mission in there, And it very much kind of, you know, cannibalizes a bit of that story for Transylvania. As well as drawing, you know, drawing on my own, you know, I got the chance to go to Transylvania a long time ago, where my family's from. So I get to use, you know, real experience as much as possible. No, but what I mean by pulp, you know, is I think that the default for a genre book is to write it in such a way that you forget that you're reading a book. Mm-hmm. You know, so the narrator, you don't know who the narrator is. It's this omniscient narrator you assume is the author. And I'm really interested in narrators. I'm really interested in who's actually telling you the story that you're reading. And I think what The Violent Century does is one of the character that most interests me in The Violent Century to an extent is who this narrator or narrators are. You know, who are they? What are they doing? And, you know, you kind of get the impression of a committee sitting in a dusty room somewhere going through all documents and trying to assemble this story. You know, my next book has about 5 different narrators in it, which is, you know, it was an interesting thing to try and do, different ways of narrating. So I think what The Violent Century does is it has a couple of distancing mechanisms in it, which I think partly the lack of quotation marks is a distancing mechanism. And it's also something that is sort of aware of itself as a book, you know, so you're not forgetting, you're not just reading an adventure, but someone's going to stop you in the middle and remind you that what you're reading is a story. If that makes sense.
And then one more question about the narrator then, because you're absolutely right that the narrator is such a clear presence in there. And if the narratee then also feels very real to me, like the use of we feels like we're being addressed. So I'm wondering who the story is being told to.
That's a good question, actually. Very good question. I'm not sure I can answer that. I do have a theory about it, which might come into a future book if I get to write it. But no, that is a very good question. I mean, in a way, that's a very difficult thing to answer, you know, from my background, because most of my career is based on writing stories set in environments that I may be, you know, intimately familiar with, but that the people who are going to be reading my stories may not be familiar with them. And it's always the question of how much do I have to explain? You know, if I'm writing a story set in Israel, how much do I have to explain to the reader? And I'm kind of assuming most of my readers may be, you know, American readers reading a magazine. So it's very, very tricky. And I think the classic example was when I wrote a book with my friend Nir in 2009 called The Tel Aviv Dossier, which is set in Tel Aviv after a sort of apocalyptic event. And we wrote it in English, and you know, but incorporating a lot of kind of little Israeli culture and Hebrew words and so on. And you have to kind of add in tiny little explanations here and there, you know, when as you're writing. And we came around to doing the Hebrew edition, the Israeli edition, a year later, I think. Someone else translated it back into Hebrew, but obviously we went over the manuscript ourselves. And we ended up just taking all these little bits out, you know, because you don't have to explain to an Israeli reader what something is that they're intimately familiar with. So it's always a bit tricky. How much do you have to explain? How much do you keep out? And I'm not a huge fan of explaining things necessarily, but it's something that's always at the back of my mind that if I'm, you know, it very much depends who reads your stuff and how much you maintain between being completely obscure to just, you know, saying, as you know, Bob, and launching into a long lecture about something.
So one of the things I thought we could go back to the book, a different aspect of the book, kind of more broadly, in the talking about fog, because we haven't talked too much about the sort of main thrust of the novel, but Fog is our main character, Fog with 2 G's. Is his name. And I'm really curious about your writing and his development as a character. I mean, he starts in the sense that his actual timeline starts, not the novel, because it doesn't follow it chronologically. He starts as somewhat this young boy who, or teenage boy who kind of has this weird stuff happening to him. He doesn't understand. He sort of gets brought into this secret organization. He's going to work for the government, for Queen and Country, that kind of thing. And we see him struggling with his primary mission of sort of, he's just supposed to observe. He's not supposed to get involved. And he constantly struggles with this refusal to get involved. And that's part of the mystery here, is when he gets called back in the present, it's kind of to get answers to things he hasn't told anybody about his experiences, including someone who I think is one of his closest friends, Oblivion. So I was curious about if you could talk a bit about developing his character throughout the novel, and sort of exploring his experiences as one of these sort of silent partners within the war.
Well, it's an interesting point you make, because in a way his story is kind of the classic science fiction wish fulfillment thing, like in Ender's Game and so on, which is someone who, you know, the bullied kid who suddenly gains powers, you know, and he can kind of take on the bullies, you know, which is kind of like pretty much the archetypal idea of a science fiction book or a superhero book. And obviously the reality isn't like that at all, you know. So the fact that he does get these things doesn't really make any difference. And it plays a lot with the idea of, say, you know, the special school that you go to, you know. And, oh, yeah, I'm going to take you to a special school for special people. And he kind of says, oh, you know, are you really going to do that? And then the old man says, well, of course not. You know, that's just ridiculous. So it's kind of playing with that idea. But, and obviously, as you said, I'm not sure how to answer any of those questions. I think it's what happens when you get caught in something that you have no control over. And in a way, the story is just about trying to assert control over your own fate, which is what it comes down to with Fogg, is when do you rebel? When do you break away from the future that's been laid down for you? Let me turn it on you. I mean, what did you think?
I particularly found Fogg's development rather compelling. I mean, I saw his actions as rebellion and being very uncomfortable with, I mean, not rebellion in sort of a broad sense, but like individual minute rebellions, sort of pushing against authority. But they almost seem to me like moral decisions on his part. Like, there's this moment when he's in, they're in Russia, he and Oblivion are in Russia, and they're just observing what's going on. They're kind of seeing what's happening, looking for the Ubermensches, which is a name I probably butchered, but they're looking to see how this whole thing operates, and they're trying to tease out information, but they're not supposed to get involved. And they get into an altercation with the Wolf, who is this sort of German, like super psycho looking guy. I mean, he's described as being very kind of terrifying. And they get in this altercation, and they get to a point where there is a Soviet fellow who's there, who is fighting with them, and Oblivion saying, we got to run. We got to go. We got to get out of here. Let's get away. And there's this hesitation on their part. They don't want to leave him. They want to help him, even though knowing that that's not their mission. And to some extent, it's probably not going to help. And it's something that happens later with another character, Tank, which I won't go into the details just so I don't ruin anything for anybody. But this hesitation to sort of just go with what is the primary mission and these sort of moral decisions, which may or may not have something to do with the fact that they share their lineage as people with power, but certainly a moral decision of what Americans would, I guess, describe as the don't leave a man behind idea. But is not put in those kinds of terms. It's very, I don't know. That's kind of what I took from it. I don't know if that's something that you imagined was going on, but that's what I took.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, like I keep saying, I've no interest in superheroes as such. And, you know, if I had to say what the Violent Century is about, it's about how, you know, you know, it's kind of like talking about the real events of the 20th century, you know, particularly World War II and the Holocaust to a smaller extent. With the kind of superheroes characters almost representing, you know, a counterbalance to it, if that makes sense. One of the, you know, and if you mention the guy in Minsk, you know, Kerach, you know, I was really intrigued. I've only seen one review to actually mention that point, that The Violent Century is essentially a Jewish novel. You know, and the characters that really fascinated me in the book are the Jewish superheroes, you know, which we see a couple of them here and there. And you know, one of the interesting things about the idea of superheroes, that they all came from these Jewish kids writing them in the 30s and 40s, but none of them were Jewish. In a way, they were Jewish because they were, you know, they had this secret identity, that they were one thing in public and another thing in private. And if you look at the people who created superheroes, who kind of have cameos in the book as well, they all changed their names to sound less Jewish, you know. So Stan Lee changed his name from Stanley Lieber, and, you know, just, you can't get any more Jewish than that. And these were kind of the things I wanted to explore, particularly in the trial section, I think, is where it really brings it to the fore, that whole idea. To me, the characters that I was interested in that kind of changed were, firstly, Clara, who's the girl that Fogg falls in love with. She changed a bit through the different drafts, partly because initially, you know, I was seeing it through Fogg's eyes, and she was always this complete innocent. You know, she was someone frozen in time, in a way, frozen in a time of innocence before the war. And it was, a couple of drafts later, and I think I got some feedback from a friend at that point. I think Shimon actually read the book, Shimon Adolf. And, you know, and he was like, I don't buy her innocence. You know, I don't see why you're portraying her as this innocent, you know, blameless person. And I began to think, you know, he's absolutely right. I mean, I became interested in what her relationship was with what was going on in the war, which is how her character, you know, becomes a lot more complicit in the activities of the Nazis, I think, in the final draft. And the other thing was with Oblivion, you know, that the first draft were very coy about Oblivion's sexuality. And, you know, and I got to draft 7 or something, I can't remember, you know, I was writing the section set in the 1950s, and I just thought, you know what, I mean, screw it, let the man have some sex, you know, and... And just, I thought, stop being so coy about it and just let him have sex. It's the 50s, for crying out loud, you know. And I was quite pleased with that decision. So it was interesting. It's interesting when you're writing and rewriting and rewriting how some of the characters kind of grow and change. And, you know, some characters had to be cut out. I wrote a section, you know, before the trial, which the trial kind of reflects the Eichmann trial. Mm-hmm. That happened in our history, and actually happened in the history of the book as well. So I actually wrote a section that replicated the Eichmann abduction, you know, when he was abducted by Mossad agents in Buenos Aires in 64. And so then you got to see a few more of the kind of Israeli superheroes, the Jewish superheroes, and so on. But it ended up getting cut from the book. Oh. No, it's going to have to be on the DVD extras.
Paul?
Yeah, I wanted to... You were mentioning, talking about Clara being frozen, about the characters growing and changing. What was the motivation for making the Ubermenschens ageless? And I can see how you were reflecting that with... the world changing around them, and I think the old man at one point talks about that, but I was just curious, what was the motivation is having them frozen like that in as far as their agelessness and timelessness?
I'm not sure. To be honest, one of the things I still want to write one day is an Immortals book. You know, I've always loved the old tribe of the Immortals who live secretly amongst us through time, you know, like Highlander. And again, it's sort of a science fiction cliche by now from Roger Zelazny from Heinlein and so on. So this isn't really my Immortals book, you know. I think these guys, you know, if you reduce it down, is that they're alive because it would be a much shorter book otherwise. So I'm not, you know, I'm not 100% sure if I can answer that.
It's certainly true to the superhero trope who go for decades without aging.
Well, I think that, well, exactly. I mean, they, you know, Superman hasn't aged, but you assume he does, but it's just that he keeps being rebooted. And in a way, I suppose these characters are kind of rebooted every decade. That's quite an interesting idea, actually. I might have to write The Violent Century 2, the reboot.
Oh, was that? Do you guys have other questions, or do we want to skip to our silly questions 5?
Go for it.
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right, you ready for silly questions, Levy?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, excellent.
Awesome. Okay, so here we go. Number 1, if you could have one superpower from your book, which would you have?
I quite like the idea of the fog, to be honest. Even though I'm much more of a warm weather person than fog. So it would be a completely useless talent to have because I would prefer living somewhere by the ocean, you know, or somewhere tropical. So it would be absolutely useless, you know, when I think about it. I quite like the idea of just, you know, you can hide yourself and no one, you know. It's why I like big cities as well, like London, is you can walk around and no one knows who you are and no one cares. Whereas, you know, I grew up in a very small, close community, so you know, and you can't escape because everyone you see recognizes you and sees you and knows everything about you. So I quite like fog's power. I would go for that.
Excellent. All right, number 2, preferred climate, Siberia or the Sahara Desert?
Well, I haven't been to the Sahara. I've been to Siberia. To be honest, when I went to Siberia, it was really, really, really nice weather there. So that's probably a bit of an unfair answer. And then I've been to the Gobi. I do like the desert. I definitely prefer hot to cold. So, yeah, definitely not Siberia in winter. Anything but Siberia in winter.
Fair enough. Just on that topic, just in case anyone hasn't seen it, there's actually a documentary by Werner Herzog on the, I think it's pronounced taiga, the people who are fur trappers up in Upper Siberia. Really worth a watch if you want to know what it's like to live in what amounts to most horrifyingly cold area almost ever. They say if it's minus 30 degrees, that's a mild day. So anyway, so question number 3, preferred profession, spy or general?
Yeah, I mean, being a spy would be kind of cool, wouldn't it? Only I'm terrible at keeping secrets. So, you know, the first cocktail party I went to and people said, so what do you do? I'd have to say, well, funny you should ask. I'm actually a spy and I'm here to acquire the, you know, the high command's secrets. So, yeah, I probably wouldn't be any good at either of these.
Fair enough. All right, so number 4. If you had to choose between a spatula or a back scratcher as a weapon, which would you choose?
Back scratcher?
Oh, come on, with your cooking, I would throw them in a spatula for sure.
Well, I've got a plastic spatula. I don't think it would be much use. Whereas, you know, I'm thinking a back scratcher, especially if you have it made out of, you know, that metal that Wolverine uses.
I thought you didn't watch superheroes.
Probably quite useful. Well, I mean, I'm aware of them in a sort of... Yeah, I tried to watch the new Wolverine movie. I lasted about 15 minutes, but at least I got the gist of it. You know, there was something about a bear, and the bear died, and he was very upset about the bear dying, and then he went to Japan. So, you know, I do try and keep up with the kids, you know, but...
Awesome. So adamantium back scratcher it is. All right. Number five. How many Ubermenches does it take to screw in a light bulb?
That's a very good question. I would say 7, although I have no idea why.
Fair enough.
Well, you need one with the power of electricity, don't you? One with the power of to control objects. Yeah, anyway, we will be here all night.
Awesome. Okay, well, so great. So that's our silly questions 5. So really quick, could you... I know you said you just turned in a novel to... or what probably is going to be a long process to get that to publication. But Violent Century came out last month, but now we've got this whole year in which you might have other stuff coming out or you're making convention appearances. So could you let folks know what we can expect from you in the the next 6 months?
Well, I mean, convention wise, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of conventions in the world, so I'll probably be in the London Worldcon just because it's literally around the corner, and I'll just show up and sit in the bar or something. But work wise, I've got a new novel that, you know, no one knows anything about very much at the moment, but it's supposed to be out for October this year, so we'll see. You know, it's all being kept under wraps at the moment. But like I said, something Hitler would be a... Let's say it's a comedy involving Hitler, you know. a sort of alternative history. So we'll see what happens with that. I've got the Apex Book of War, SF3, coming out this year, which is my third and final anthology of international science fiction stories. I've got 2 more anthologies that I'm doing at the moment that I can't really talk about, but are very, very cool. Very pulpy fun, that I'm doing for charity. I've got a comics coming out. I've got my first mainstream comics title coming out in about October, I think, October, November, called Adler, based on the adventures of Irene Adler from Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, nice. And
yeah, it's sort of like the League of Extraordinary Gentlewomen, I think, is the rough pitch. But it's great fun. Again, it's something that started off as a screenplay just because I got really annoyed with how Irene Adler was portrayed in the TV and the films, you know, which I couldn't bear to watch. So I got very annoyed, wrote a screenplay, forgot all about it, and then ended up getting a comics deal to do it. So it's great. And it's with an artist called Paul McCaffrey that I've worked with in the past, and it's going to be released by Titan Comics. So that's very, very cool. I've seen some of the artwork already, and it looks fantastic. And that's a great steampunky, you know, steampunky fun adventure thing. Hopefully making some serious points, you know, but ideally just a fun title. So one novel, one comics miniseries. It's a 5-issue miniseries launching this year. 3 anthologies. I think I'm supposed to have a short story collection of guns and sorcery stories coming out. Ooh. But who knows? Yeah, is that? I mean, there's probably a few other things, but you know, I can't think off the top of my head. And there's a film. I've spent last year doing a film for some production company, so that's going to go into the next stage this year. We'll see if we can get a director attached, and then see what happens.
Well, awesome, that's great. So really quick, just let everyone know where they can find you so they can, you know, obviously keep track of this information over the year.
Yeah, well, I'm mostly hanging about on Twitter, which is kind of sad, but it's Levitidar on Twitter, or my website is levitidar.wordpress.com. Quite easy to find online.
And we'll put links in there for everybody so they can check it out. So, awesome. Well, thank you, Levi, for coming on and talking to us about the Violent Century and your work. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks to Paul and David for joining me, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. We'll see everybody next time.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
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 If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.